Well, let me just begin by asking you, what made you run for lieutenant governor?
Well, I think you would really have to rewind the tape and ask a person who's been in business their whole life. I've been in the restaurant and hospitality business since 1986. Why you entered, you know, the arena of public service and why you ran for the state house. I've served three terms in the Alaska State House and the legislature. The first term as a co-chair of resources, and then twice as the single chair of the Judiciary Committee. And after finishing my third term of office, it was becoming apparent to me that laws are made two different kinds of ways. They're made from the top down, where government decides what's best for you, and oftentimes, in spite of good intentions, it misses the mark. And the other way that public policy is made is from the bottom up, where a community, whether it's a PTA or a school or a municipality or a group of concerned citizens, get together, they foster and incubate an issue. They take it and tug it and pull it and drive it through their local group. They take it to Juneau, and they try and galvanize support for it. And sometimes it succeeds and sometimes it sputters. Sometimes you find that it is subject to a local solution or no solution. And sometimes there is an extrapolation and an application that fits for the state of Alaska. And I enjoy participating in that discussion. So serving in the legislature, you tend to watch issues that rise up. And you see a lot of issues that crash from the top down. And I see in pursuing the position of lieutenant governor that you can have a bully pulpit and you can talk to the public and participate, I think, at the local and community level in creating issues that become important statewide issues. And I'm attracted to it because the lieutenant governor position, if you look at the narrowly described duties in the Alaska State Constitution, are quite important but unremarkable.
I guess that I have a couple next natural questions then. One
sure.
is, as somebody who would be in a position that is near the top of government in the state, how do you foster that bottom-up mentality?
Well, first, if I can call a line from that movie Talladega Nights, if you're not first, then you're first loser. And lieutenant governor is a million miles away from being governor. You're certainly not a loser, but you are a million miles away from being the chief executive. And it's very important for people that are running for lieutenant governor, and I think for the voters when they're considering who's running, that you certainly want to vet somebody as an understudy for the chief executive position, but unless there were circumstances like the very unusual circumstances that Alaska went through some time ago, 16 months ago, that generally speaking, the governor stays healthy. Alaska is, there's a lot of rollicking in primaries and general elections, but once we elect people, things are very orderly. And so we want to be mindful that the person running for lieutenant governor wants to be the lieutenant governor and wants to do those duties assigned and then determine how to participate. Now, I have, I believe, a narrowness of purpose. For instance, I was one of the prime sponsors for the 90-day session, which is the overhaul of the legislative session from 121 days to 90 days. Now, overseeing ballot measures is a critical part of what a lieutenant governor does, and I developed the language, collected 100 signatures, then went out and collected 47,000 signatures with Senator Wagner out of the Kenai, who was a Republican, and Senator Gretchen Guess out of Anchorage, who was a Democrat. They were the other two prime sponsors. I was the driver of that. We put it on the ballot in 2006. We now have had three successful legislative sessions of a 90-day session, and mind you, the longer legislative session, we generally pass laws so that we look germane to the process, but usually we're taking liberties away from you. We generally turn the screw one way. So many of us subscribe to the idea that the less time that we're down there, the less damage we can do to the public. So when it comes to running for lieutenant governor, I'm interested in being able to communicate with the public and crisscrossing the state of Alaska and keeping my ear close to the ground and finding out what's important to people and bringing it back to the legislature and to the executive branch. And fostering dialogue is really, I think, the most important intangible duty that is should be assigned to the lieutenant governor.
Isn't part of the role, though, kind of determined by the governor you're serving with? I mean, there's, you know, how much does that determine what you want to do before you know who the governor is going to be and what you're able to do once you're in the job?
That is certainly true, as is the cliche that you should choose your battles. But it's like any employment relationship. You have an employer, you have a boss, you take orders from the boss, but there is always an opportunity for original thought and self-expression within a job duty. And a lieutenant governor is a very loosely articulated position. I just sat with our sitting lieutenant governor, Craig Campbell, last week, and he expressed to me he thought it should be a part-time position because there was so much slack time in the position. And I think that although he's been very successful in the position and has chosen not to run for a full term, I think that if a person wants to approach it as a job that requires some hours to execute those duties, they can find that definition in the job. And if a person wants to find a job that is leaves you oversubscribed for your time, where you are out and about and really trying to encourage international trade, tourism, discussion and dialogue between various communities, that you can define the role of lieutenant governor that way. And I prefer to set a course like that. I have a reputation in my hometown and across the state as a campaigner to be a very hard worker, you know, 60, 80, 100-hour work weeks. If you're in the tourism industry, you grow quite accustomed to that. And my hospitality background, it's a great living. It's just not an easy living, and usually you make it up with sweat equity, and I've never been afraid to sweat equity my way into doing a job successfully.
Let's talk a little bit about the tourism industry. It's one of the big concerns here in Southeast.
Yes, it should be.
Yeah. How do you bolster the industry or make up for the losses in cruise ship passengers? I mean, we're seeing passengers decline, trying at the same time to, you know, bring in destination tourists who are going to be here, you know, without a ship maybe. So where's the balance? Where's the fix? How do you promote tourism and or make up for the losses?
Well, things happen slowly. Things go well slowly, and things fall apart slowly, generally, unless there's some event that, you know, it triggers something more significant. In this case, with tourism, we have seen a very lovely incremental growth for quite a number of years, certainly since the year 2000. We've seen steady growth of 3 to 5 to 8% annually. And it peaked in 2008, which was regarded largely across the state as a very successful tour season. As the cruise ship ballot initiative passed, and it was a very cluttered, dense, poorly understood, poorly articulated ballot initiative, and it resulted in some very significant tax increases. Now, folks will argue that the downturn was because of the economy, that the tax component relative to the cost of a cruise tour or a cruise tour and a land tour, that there wasn't a great relationship. But I subscribe to the notion that taxes change behavior. Anybody who has a business does irrational things in December for no other reason than because your accountant tells you so, or IRS rules that separate, you know, December 31 into one calendar year and January 1 into another calendar year. And so as we saw the head tax really take a very dominant and obtuse position in the marketplace, I think it changed behavior, and we saw ships that left Alaska. So I applaud Governor Parnell for stepping in, and I thought it took a lot of political courage to execute the approach that he took after being down in Miami and talking to the industry. And I think that we will see a turnaround in the industry. I think although we're seeing an anemic 2010, and it's highly likely that 2011 will also be a soft year, I am an optimist, and I do believe that beginning in 2012, we're going to see a movement of more ships coming to Alaska. Secondly, I think that the demographics of the baby boomers are such that not all of them want to take organized cruise and land tours, and that we are going to see more people traveling to Alaska on self-directed tours. And I think that's going to benefit the Sitka area greatly. Sitka is one of the prettiest places in all of Alaska, especially if you catch it on a sunny day. And I've been down here 3 times in the last 3 months, and I've been lucky 1 out of 3 times, which is good luck. That's about the same luck that you have of seeing Mount McKinley if you travel to Denali. And I think that we're going to see a real demographic change with baby boomers. And I think that we're going to see more infrastructure across the inside passage that is going to lead to more harbors and more cruise ships coming into the area. And I think it's going to result over time in more rail cars, more motor coaches, more hotels, more experiential opportunities like rafting and flight seeing. And I think that Alaska should set its sights not on 1 million passengers through the Inside Passage, but 2 million passengers in the Inside Passage. But it may take us, you know, a quarter century to get there, but you have to have goals, and I think that would be a good goal for Alaska.
Back to the cruise ship initiative, it was an initiative, from the citizens, and so that strikes me as kind of a bottom-up thing, but it also, you know, in your view, hasn't worked. Where's the are those two ideas, are they in conflict with each other?
Well, government is always in conflict with itself. The natural tension that exists between the state house and the state senate, between the legislative branch and the executive branch, between those two branches and the judiciary. Our democracy thrives on tension and some unreasonable body doing something extraordinarily unreasonable. A lot of my Democrat friends would tell you that the U.S. Supreme Court has just done that with this We the People deal that changed campaign disclosure laws. A lot of my Republican friends would tell you that the U.S. Congress and the president just did that with health care reform. So I think we're always a pendulum that is swinging. With regard to the 90-day session that we talked about earlier, I'm threatened all the time by my colleagues, an ever-diminishing number of them, that threatened that it's a bad public policy as they see it, and they would like to change it back to 121 days and thwart the will of the people. And so the rules, the statute book, allows that after 2 years you can modify a ballot initiative. Some ballot initiatives are very clearly written, and it's a very easy policy to say, yes, I'm for that, or no, I'm against it. Some are more densely written. I think that we will see here in Sitka, as across the state, that this notion of the anti-corruption ballot initiative is going to be a very complex, dense piece of public policy that has good intentions, but is so obtuse, to use that word again, that it's going to be difficult to effectively use it as a tool. And so if it does pass, I would expect it to be, A, challenged in court, and secondly, to be modified by the legislature. On the other hand, the general obligation bond that we're going to vote on, which I'm a yes for, which is a $475 million education bond that includes the $20 million for the new school at Mount Edgecombe, or for the new swimming pool in the Mount Edgecombe school. That's a pretty straightforward deal. When folks read that and what is involved in that $475 million, it will be pretty explicit and specific, whereas the anti-corruption piece is going to be pretty vague. And, of course, we're in court arguing right now about the parental notification issue, which looked pretty clear, and then we come to find out that although I support it, we come to find out that a doctor who doesn't inform the parents is then guilty of a felony. Is embedded in this ballot initiative. So these ballot initiatives are a form of direct democracy, which I support, but they are less than perfect, as is our form of democracy and the way we pass laws to begin with anyway.
You said every region of the state has the right to build its own economy.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
Well, to me, it's a centerpiece of what Alaska must look like going forward. We have interesting divides here in Alaska. We have an urban-rural divide. We have a native-non-native divide. We have a commercial fishing versus a sport fishing divide. If you look at the issue going on in Pebble, you have two resources, a renewable and a non-renewable resource, side by side, competing with one another. And it really is an interesting tension for Alaska to deliberate and contend with and find its way in defining. We have many urban Alaskans that are quite concerned about the communities as they are evolving, say, out in western Alaska, where there isn't an economy and there is 70 and 80% unemployment. I think there's a cover article in the Anchorage Daily News today about new small businesses cropping up in Amonic. Amonic was one of the 11 western villages a year ago where there was starvation, where, in fact, my office and we organized an effort to do we created a supply chain and airlifted 40,000 pounds of food to Amonic and 10 other villages last year who were in some degree of dire need. And so how do we create an economy, not just in Anchorage where you have 300,000 people and goods and services chasing each other, but how do you do it in other more stressed areas like Sitka or Ketchikan, who have been done in by the long arm of the federal government coming in and encroaching on timber issues. Now, whether you are for protecting the old growth forests or not, we certainly recognize that the mill shut down, that it became Silver Bay Seafoods, that we lost an industry that employed 1,000 people in Sitka. The challenge then is for Sitka, to talk about this community for a moment, to be able to rebuild, reshape, and redefine its own economy. One of my trip here in March or April, I took a tour of the Silver Bay Seafoods facility. Now, I believe that the old mill was given to the city, and the city sold it to the Silver Bay folks for a dollar, I think, or a lease agreement. I can't remember the specifics. But that's a fantastic way for Sitka to have redefined its economy. And we have this issue in Fairbanks. Fairbanks, where I'm from, born and raised, is a diesel economy, and not with a temperate climate like we have down here in Sitka. You cannot build a successful economy on diesel in subarctic temperatures. You will not be rewarded by the global marketplace for that. You have the Kenai area, which, although they have a thriving sport fish community, the other part of Kenai that we hear less about is Nikiski. Nikiski is where the Agrium and urea fertilizer plant was located and shut down. That's where the Conoco LNG export facility was exporting 100 BCF of gas a year. That's 100 billion cubic feet. This past 2 years, they averaged closer to 25 billion cubic feet. They're on the cusp of shutting down. The BP gas to liquids experimental area shut down. There are concerns about the aging status of the Tesoro refinery. We must allow these areas to maintain and create an economy. And an economy often is driven by infrastructure that is provided by the state of Alaska. And so it is a complicated how we can assist regions in building the infrastructure that will allow an economy to have anchors and to grow. You know, the Mat-Su is a lot of retail and a bedroom community to Anchorage. You can live successfully in the Mat-Su if you want to commute 50 minutes to Anchorage, but it's very difficult to have a job in a service industry as a cashier at a Fred Meyer or a Walmart or a Target or a Walgreens or a Dairy Queen and see your way to owning a home in the Mat-Su based on a job like that. Those are good jobs and they're important jobs in an economy, but we have to have a ladder in each economy that leads to home ownership, that leads to savings, that leads to wealth creation, that leads to creating employment, that leads to a dignity that comes from having a successful community.
And so going back to the office you would hold, how would the Lieutenant Governor's office serve that end?
Today I was at the Chamber of Commerce, and we were hearing a report on whole tunas that were sushi grade. You know, we have an opportunity to create a value-added export market from Alaska. And my background is in the private sector. I've been in the restaurant and hotel business self-made since 1986. And until a couple of months ago, I employed 250 people. Now it's down to about 200, and half of those jobs are seasonal. I understand what it's like to make a payroll, to meet debt service, to create things of value. When you create something of value, the municipality is able to tax it. We always hope fairly with property taxes, or as in this community, a property tax and a sales tax. And we want to have, I think, people in the legislative branch, but also in the executive branch, that understand how business is created and how commerce is done. And I think that there is a value in engaging a dialogue in a community. If you come into a Chamber of Commerce meeting and you've read some books on economics, it's entirely different than having sweated a payroll or sweated a monthly debt service in a downturning economy where you've been cash flow negative for 2 or 3 or 5 or 10 months and you have to chart your way forward. I think that there is empathy when you talk to somebody about social issues. If you've been homeless or you have literacy issues or you have substance abuse issues, I think you can talk to somebody else in that social arena with a little more empathy than somebody who's read up on the topic. It reminds me of that movie Good Will Hunting, where the young Matt Damon character had read all these things but had experienced very little. And I think that when it comes to having a background in business, that if you are in business, you can understand other businesses, you understand other cycles of commerce, and I really subscribe to the old cliche that a rising tide lifts all boats, and we need healthier economic and business cycles in Alaska with more regularity, with less seasonality, with more predictability, and I think I can participate in that dialogue better than some others.
All right, let's move to energy. Specifically, the most topical question is how will what's going on in the Gulf of Mexico right now with the BP oil spill affect Alaska's energy policy?
Well, Alaska's energy policy is extraordinarily complicated. We have a federal umbrella over us at all times, and then we have a state umbrella. The federal umbrella and the state umbrella both principally have a regulatory component and a fiscal component, meaning taxes. So the Liberty Project that BP is doing right now, for instance, it's on federal ground, and so it's subject to federal jurisdiction and the federal taxation. Now, the federal taxation is less onerous than state taxation, and BP has gone on record many times saying that if it were on state land, it would not be an economic project to pursue. Much of the development in the Prudhoe Basin is on state land. Almost all of it is. I think that we are going to see a slowdown when it comes to development in the Chukchi and the Beaufort Sea and any offshore development. I think we are seeing those signals from the EPA, from President Obama, and from many members of Congress. And so I anticipate certainly this slowdown with shale oil that has been talked about. We all hope that the delay doesn't go on any further than that. When it comes to onshore drilling, I believe that Alaska is going to be the beneficiary of policy if Alaska is proactive and takes a lead in sitting down and chooses to revisit its regulatory and fiscal framework. The marketplace is dynamic. And in this case, whereas the Gulf of Mexico and the whole Gulf Coast has been over the last decade a much more desirable place to drill, more attractive fiscal terms, less onerous regulatory provisions, and larger basins to discover, whereas the Prudhoe Bay Basin is in decline. I think now, with all the sunken costs on the North Slope, and its predictability, even though it is in decline, and as they say, as we hear from all the producers, large and small, all the easy oil is gone. But now, even if there is heavy oil to lift and less desirable oil to lift, I think with our sunken costs and with the pendulum on Gulf oil really swinging against development in the near term for that, there's an opportunity for Alaska really to sit down and review and revisit our policies and procedures and to try to attract some of that capital before it finds somewhere else to go. The world and the United States have a craving, as President Bush once said, an addiction to oil. So the world is not going to switch to windmills and solar and tidal and bicycles. We're going to continue to use oil for transportation fuel, principally. And so that capital is going to find a place to go. There are 140 oil provinces around the world. Alaska is one of them. It's largely in decline. We need to work harder to be more attractive, and we can do that during this interim by reviewing and revisiting our fiscal and regulatory framework.
Does loosening, I hear you kind of saying that it's now might be the time to loosen some of that framework.
I think it's time to have a discussion about that. I was one of 17 legislators that signed a letter saying that we should review the ACES tax provisions last year. The governor proposed some modest changes. They didn't go far enough for many of us in the legislature, and it was quite a divisive issue amongst the producers. The producers are Exxon, Conoco, and BP, and often their objectives are lumped together, hence we call them the producers. But that's a little bit like saying Alaska Natives. You can say that sometimes, but there are many Alaska Native interests, whether it's Athabascans or Yupiks or Inupiats or Tlingits or Haida, and it's that way with the producers as well. They have different objectives, and Exxon's objective was Point Thompson to protect that asset. Conoco's objective before the untimely death of Jim Bowles appeared to be to demonstrate that management could in fact have some change or effect on tax policy in Alaska. And BP was very careful not to accept a small incremental change when they wanted more significant change, and they were afraid that a small incremental change would lead to the legislature and the executive branch saying, what, we gave you changes last year, why aren't you satisfied with that? So they wanted to hold out for broader, more sweeping changes. So in this case, all of the producers had different objectives, even though we tend to lump them together.
Does loosening that fiscal framework, though, will that impact the state budget?
Well, I hope so. Many of us believe that the operating budget for the state of Alaska is totally out of control. And the capital budget is handled differently than you or I would handle things. If we made $5 billion next year, and I wish that kind of success on you. If we made that, we would see to our needs, and then presumably we would put the rest into savings. And we would think that let's make as much as we can now and put it into savings, and then we'll make as much as we can next year and put it into savings. And we might buy this or buy that and buy a boat and buy a motorhome and buy a four-wheeler or two and buy a vacation home, maybe somewhere warm. But when it comes to the way that the state spends money, it's driven by a lot of these political variables that are much more full contact, more like the NFL. And the difficulty is that we want to spend all of it all the time. And that's why we're going to see the governor take out his red veto pen next week. And we all hope that it won't include money that's set aside for Blue Lake, which will lead to an expansion of the hydro economy for cheaper kilowatts here in the Sitka area. But the difficulty is that as we extract more taxes on resources, it leads to less exploration and development. And at a certain point, the field up on the North Slope is weakened by that exploration. And I will remind folks that one-third of the oil that we project to be flowing through the Trans-Alaska Pipeline 5 years from now has not yet been discovered. So if our tax policy is too onerous, it will lead to a drop-off in exploration, and then we will see a precipitous decline. Right now, we're experiencing about a 6% year-over-year decline of throughput in the pipeline, and yet we're seeing an 8 to 10% increase in our operating budget. If you graph out those two lines, it's not too many years from now that we're in trouble. So if we spend a disproportionate amount of money each year on capital projects, which with an ever-escalating operating cost for the state, and we see a decline in barrels of oil, and we see the price of oil decline where it was a month ago at $88. Yesterday it was at 72. I didn't see how it closed today. Then, you know, we have an impending mathematical problem that would fit under the heading of, you know, are you smarter than a fifth grader? And it doesn't take too much mathematics to recognize that we could get to the year 2013, 14, or 15 and be in a lot of trouble. And so some of us believe that with less tax revenue collected, we lengthen the life of the oil fields, which gets us closer to using Outer Continental Shelf oil, NPRA oil, offshore oil, perhaps someday ANWR oil, which lengthens the life of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline as a productive transportation facility for 50 more years and will allow us, even if we don't enjoy royalty payments on some of that oil that comes with the federal fingers clutching it, we certainly can lengthen the life of onshore Alaskan oil. And, of course, we have the opportunity to fight in Congress for a better division of the royalties that would come from federal oil, much like Louisiana has been enjoying post-Katrina.